So welcome all to this latest seminar in the Migration, Ethnicity and Race Seminar Series, organised by the International Inequalities Institute with the Department of Social Policy at the LSE. I'm Lucinda Platt, and I'm going to be sharing today's seminar, in which Professor Kirsten Sainbrook will be talking about new perspectives on intra-regional migration. The event is being live streamed on Facebook. We also have a new format for this term where all of the attendees can be seen. So please do keep your camera on, and remember to keep your microphone muted, please. Kirsten Sainbrook is British Academy Global Professor and Distinguished Policy Fellow in the International Inequalities Institute at the LSE. She has previously worked at the Universidad de Chile, Universidad Diego Portales, and the University of California, Berkeley. As part of her British Academy Global Professorship, she studies the conceptualization and the measurement of the quality of employment in developing countries from the perspective of the capability approach. And she has established a summary indicator of job quality for 13 Latin American countries. I'm delighted to be chairing a session in which Professor Sainbrook will be talking about this work. She's going to talk for about 40 minutes, and then there will be about 20 minutes for questions. The event will end at 2 p.m. London time. So without more ado, I'll hand over to Kirsten to start her talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lucinda, and thank you for having me on this seminar, in this seminar series. And well, first of all, as you said, I'm going to be talking about intra-regional migration, in particular the case of Chile. But before starting, I'd first of all like to thank my co-authors, Mauricio Apablaza, Veronica Arrigada, and Roberto González, who've been working with me on this project for quite some time, and who during the last week sacrificed bits of their holiday, summer holiday, to help me get some of the data out and recalculate some of the data. So, there are sort of several motivations for this paper, which I'll come to in a minute, but really something that we don't normally think about when we think of the case of Chile is that it's now become one of the world's top five destination countries for migrants. They've received a tremendous amount of immigrants from different countries in Latin America. And it's a country which has a very liberal immigration system. So we'll talk about this during the course of the presentation. And of course, this raises big issues about how migrants are integrating in the labor market and how they're doing overall. And I think the figures, you know, in terms of how many immigrants are arriving are really quite staggering. So it makes this a particularly interesting case study. Now, with regards to the motivations for this paper, first of all, there's a sort of theoretical motivation to try and see whether the vast majority of the literature on this topic is about developed countries, and they look at labour markets in a particular way. So the first question really is, well, do these assumptions hold in the global south? But there's the other aspect to this paper is this quality of employment index that we've been working on for a number of years, that we've now calculated for the whole of Latin America, and we're currently involved in two projects. The first is to calculate the indicator with the United Nations in Latin America so that we can publish it on a regular basis and inform National Institutes of Statistics. And we're also calculating it for the Chilean government, which is going to be the first developing country to design a job quality index, which will be published regularly in future together with the unemployment rates. So we've got this index now, we've got the methodology, it can be adapted to individual countries, it can be adapted to an international scenario for comparative purposes. And we're looking at various different applications of this index. And so looking at migrants is one way of testing this index, looking at how it can be used, seeing how we can apply it to, for example, help identify the most vulnerable workers in the labour market, both among the local population and the migrant population. And of course, to, in this case in particular, identify horizontal inequalities in the labour market between migrants and the local population. And of course, the other purpose of this indicator is to inform policy debates in the destination countries, in this case, Chile. In general, in Latin America, intra-regional immigration is quite an understudied subject, and this is mostly due to the fact that there's a lack of reliable data across countries and also within countries. So most of the studies that we've seen so far are qualitative or case studies or based on data that is quite limited in many cases. And I certainly know of no similar study that examines the quality of employment of migrants in this way that I'm about to present, but I might be wrong. So if I am, please let me know. But these are the three motivations for the paper. And I'll follow sort of a standard procedure with a very, very brief literature review, some contextualization. Then I'll present the methodology. We use the Alkire-Foster method to measure job quality. This is the same method that is widely used internationally and also within countries to measure multidimensional poverty. So what we've done is we've adapted this methodology to the subject of the quality of employment. And I'll discuss how we did that in detail before coming to the findings, the analysis, and then potential policy conclusions. But before I start with this, I did want to say that we had a qualitative component to this study when we started out. Unfortunately, I can't read my own quotations completely because the Zoom images are in the way. But just to give you an idea, many of the qualitative studies have focused on individual cases of migration within Chile. And there's a lot of, there are positive and there are also some quite negative stories about how migrants are integrating. And of course, these studies have the virtue of portraying individual scenarios or case study scenarios or regional scenarios where there's a concentration of immigration and where migrants have a much, much stronger voice. So at the end of the day, what we're looking at in this study is just the available data to see how migrants integrate. But I did want to show you some of our quotations from our qualitative work, field work. The first one basically shows how little migrants sometimes know about the labour market in Chile, about regulation. It's from a Peruvian preschool teacher who basically said, "I had no idea that we could have a labour contract. I had no idea that they had to pay my social security. I had no idea they had to pay my health insurance. I had no benefit. I didn't claim it because I didn't know." So that's one quite common scenario that you find when talking to migrants, especially when you talk to migrants who have recently arrived. But then the longer, of course, they stay in the country, the more they find out about this. In particular, actually, because Chile is also very liberal about making its own social policies available to migrants. So once you've become a resident in the country, you can apply for social security benefits, for housing benefits, and so on. Another example is from what I've seen, that is the typical sort of the way migrants are stereotyped by employers, by other Chileans, by themselves also. And so you find a lot of migrants working in particular categories. So Bolivians as nannies, Peruvians as those cleaning hotels, Colombians work in bars. They are marked by their stereotypes. That's a Venezuelan social worker who says this. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have a lot of employers. And I have to say, in all my research in Chile, I haven't found any employer who's been negative about immigration and the impact of immigration in Chile. And many have very, very specific strategies where they, for example, say, "I only employ Colombians, forget Chileans, they don't know the meaning of customer service." Because people who come to Chile from other countries, especially from places like Colombia, are often friendlier, are very good at dealing with customers and so on. So many immigrant groups have a very positive reputation and employers find their way into certain immigrant networks and then recruit specifically from that network from a particular country or from a particular group of immigrants. But of course, there's also a downside. One employer once said to me, "I only employ Haitians, they're docile." And the word that this guy used, this was a Chilean employer who runs a garden, a very, very large garden center. This word docile, mansitos, is normally a word that you apply to animals. So dogs are mansitos or horses are mansitos. And what this guy liked basically is that the Haitians came and they didn't really know very much about their rights. He could pay them minimum wage, maybe less, I don't know. And they would do as they're told. And whereas the implication was that Chilean workers have become way too uppity. So there is all of this context, which of course, with a quantitative study, we can't capture. And there's a lot of information out there that isn't contained in the story. So I just wanted to let you know that I'm aware of those types of studies. But overall, the picture that we're getting from the quantitative information and from the survey data that we're using in this study is actually very positive. Now, in terms of the literature on immigration, what we've seen from studies in developed countries, and this is really a very sort of brief summary, I'm aware that there's much more out there, is that they tend to assume tightly regulated immigration procedures and systems with sophisticated institutional arrangements. They assume relatively tight labor markets with mostly formal employment. They assume that participation and wages pretty much sum up the position of migrants in a labour market. And there are, of course, some exceptions like Puri, who looks at segmentation between good and low quality jobs, or some studies look at in particular at certain economic sectors. But there are sort of some general assumptions that are repeated in the literature. When, of course, Chile is a very different scenario because it is still, even though it's classified officially as a developed country now or as a high income country, it really does function still as a developing economy. Now, migrants are coming from different ethnic backgrounds and from different nationalities to Chile. Unfortunately, the ethnic penalty and discrimination literature can't be replicated in Chile, and I'll explain why. And we can't really look at labour market dynamics either. So how do migrants progress in the labour market? And this is mostly because migration is such a recent phenomenon that there's no history to look at, or at least not history with enough data. And then there's certainly a lot of literature that documents heterogeneous performance of different groups of migrants in the destination country, and we'll see that in Chile as well. But most of these questions we can address in Chile and we can look at. So I'll be showing you as we go along with the data how they pan out. Now, in terms of the quality of employment literature, again, this is a very, very brief summary. There's pretty much an international consensus now that we should be measuring the quality of employment or the quality of work or job quality, however it's called. This is also included in one of the Sustainable Development Goals. It's goal 8A. In the UNDP list of indicators that we should be looking at. It's listed as decent work in that indicator, or decent jobs. The problem with this entire framework, though, is that there's no specific conceptualization or measurement of decent work or job quality at the international level. There have been a number of ILO studies. They all have different methodologies, and at the end they include a very, very broad range of variables, and the consensus has been to say, okay, each country can publish what they can given the data that they have. Then there have been some academic studies, for example, Francis Green and Mustafa, who produced an indicator for Europe with Eurofound data, and the OECD also has produced an indicator. Now, what these indicators have in common is that they're dashboard indicators, which means that they look at individual indicators and individual dimensions of job quality separately. And so one of the reasons that we undertook this study is to show what we can actually do with a synthetic indicator. Because if you have a dashboard indicator, which compiles a range of different measures and variables, when you start breaking them down into different groups of the population, it very quickly becomes messy and you lose track of what's actually going on. So what we hope to show with this paper is indeed how these indicators can be used when they're constructed in a synthetic way. And the other important thing is that this is not, this measure of the quality of employment that we've developed, it's not intended to be used as a substitute for unemployment rates and wages, etc. It's meant to be used as a complementary indicator. And in fact, it actually includes wages as an indicator. Now, this is the graph that shows you how recent a phenomenon migration is in Chile and how quickly migration has expanded. And the part of the slide that you probably can't see under the Zoom images is the bit that tells you that they now constitute 8.6% of the Chilean labor force. And we have different nationalities, and you can see how some of these colors have expanded, in particular since 2015. So for example, the difference with Peruvian immigrants who have been coming for a while, or at least, well, last 10 years or so, or 20 years, Venezuelans started arriving really only in greater numbers from 2015 onwards. The same with people from Haiti, and Colombians have also started arriving in greater numbers more recently. So this is really the most extraordinary increase in migration. And remember, Chile is a very small country. It's a labour market of about 8 million workers. And so suddenly, if you have a million migrants that you integrate into your labour market, that's quite a steep challenge. Now, again, this is a graph about the destination country, sorry, the countries of origin and their level of development. So the grey shaded area here shows you their GDP per capita level in the last 10 years. And what's very important here is, I mean, this pattern hasn't really shifted with the exception of Venezuela, which basically started to tank after, well, in particular after 2015, but it has been tanking for a while. And it's precisely as the economic situation and also the political situation in Venezuela deteriorates that immigrants come in increased numbers to Chile. And Chile very much opens its doors to Venezuelans. I'll discuss that in a minute as well. It's considered to be a humanitarian visa that Venezuelans get when they come to Chile. So this gives you a bit of an explanation of how different the levels of GDP per capita are in these different countries. And that explains in large part why immigrants are coming from those countries to Chile and not from other places. Now, in general, Latin America has not only a liberal tradition of immigration regimes or liberal systems of immigration, but they've also got a historical tradition of allowing immigrants into their countries, especially during the time of the dictatorships in the 70s and 80s. Latin Americans that escaped one country for political reasons were admitted very easily to other countries in the region. But of course, when there were political reasons for immigration, the numbers of immigrants were much, much lower. So what we're seeing now is mostly immigrants who come for economic reasons as well as political reasons in the case of Venezuela. And they have four types of visas, sort of basic types of visas that they can apply for in Chile, for both workers and their family members. The first type of visa is basically just an employment contract. So if you have a contract of employment, you have the right to stay in Chile and you can apply for permanent status after only 2 years. You can come as a student or as a temporary residence, or you can seek political asylum or refugees. And that's, of course, a category that's very small in Latin America. A large category recently has been the special visas for Venezuelans. Venezuelans don't even require a current passport to enter Chile because it's recognized that the Venezuelan government has long stopped issuing new passports. So any kind of ID is accepted or passports that have run out, etc. So that they've been very, very flexible on this. And of course, those who come in as workers can also stay with their families. And even if people come in as tourists and then decide to switch, they aren't really sanctioned. So deportations have started recently because the whole immigration, the volume of immigration has started to debate about immigration legislation. And there's been a first reform, there's debate of more reforms about whether they want to tighten up these procedures. And this government at the moment has also started deporting some people who were in Chile illegally. Really, to get kicked out of Chile, you have to be there illegally or legally and have committed a crime. That's the most commonly stated reason for deporting people. But still, it remains a very, very liberal regime where basically, if you come to Chile with an employment contract or with a possibility of finding employment, you have the right to stay. Now, again, this slide shows you how quickly the migrant population increased. This is now data from the labour force survey. So you can see that in 2010, we only had about 1,000 migrants. And now we have almost 3,000 cases in the survey. And that, of course, increases our proportion of migrants in the labour market to about just over 10% in the sample. So we've actually now got, for the first time, data that we can work with. And we, until recently, only had data until 2018. The 2019 survey just came out, so we've recalculated everything. because this greater number of immigrants, of course, allows us to make better use of the data. Now, just to look at some general indicators, overall, at a sort of first glance, migrants do very well in the labour market. They have a lower proportion of inactive population. They have a much higher proportion of economically active population. They have roughly the same unemployment rate, and the female participation rate is much, much higher than among Chileans. And so overall, certainly in terms of the quantity of their participation in the labour market, they are doing very well. Now, we do have some data limitations. It's only recently that these surveys have started to capture a large enough number of cases, as I showed you. We only have data on legal activities and households with an address. So by legal activities, I actually don't mean the person selling fruit in the street or something, but I mean literally illegal activities which are not included in surveys. And of course, the issue of having a permanent address is also very important, because even though the surveys capture camps and shanty towns, etc., there's much more fluctuation there in terms of how people move around, and the likelihood that they'll be captured by the survey is lower. What we can't examine yet with the data is anything to do with the dynamics of migrants, because this phenomenon is very recent, as you saw. Now, we know that there's a discrimination in Chile based on both the country of origin and the colour scale or ethnic background of migrants. But first of all, this is not a question that's included in the surveys. We know the nationality of people, but we don't know anything about whether they're darker, lighter, more Indian, less Indian. And so this is something that we have no information at all on at the moment. And we also still, even though we have many more migrants now in our samples, we still have difficulty breaking them down into smaller groups. So anything to do with more than one variable that we want to break down becomes difficult. Informality is the typical measure that people look at when they think about job quality, apart from wages. And we can only start calculating that from 2017 onwards, because the Chilean government didn't include the full range of variables that you need for that definition in the labour force survey before then. And I would say that generally data after 2017 is more reliable anyway. So I'm going to show you the full range of data that we have, but I'm going to focus on the last 3 years. Now, the first question is, well, why should we and how should we measure the quality of employment? So just a little bit here about the methodology. The Alcaya-Foster methodology is very well known and established now. So governments know it, international institutions use it, and it's become a very established way of measuring multidimensional phenomena. So the important thing actually for us in this case is that we can go into a room full of people whom we don't know in whatever country, especially in the global south, and they will know enough about multidimensional poverty to be able to understand what we're doing with the quality of employment and how we're measuring it. So that's incredibly useful when you're coming out with the idea of measuring the quality of employment, which is not something that is normally measured. We also think it's a very effective method for public policy purposes, because it focuses on deprivation and on the most vulnerable in the labour market. And it does so in a way which is not captured just simply by wages, and I'll show you exactly how that pans out. What's also important about this methodology is it's easy to calculate and replicate, and also easy to explain. So it's press efficient, governments understand it, it's quite easy to present this information. And of course, the other advantage of this is it allows us to decompose the labour market by subgroups, by particular dimensions, to summarise and analyse. And I should also add to this point that it allows us to look at joint distributions, so to look at joint deprivations. Are people deprived in wages and other employment conditions and something else, or is it just, for example, wages? Of course, we had to adapt this methodology to labour markets, and so this is really sort of the most complex step of this procedure, because all of these Well, first of all, the dimensions are pretty clear. These actually come from the OECD indicator, labour income, employment stability and employment conditions. There's pretty much an international consensus on the fact that these are the most important dimensions. The question then becomes, when you look at individual countries or a group of countries, which indicators can you use to measure these dimensions? So that is a step that depends very much on the available data. And then you have to decide, well, in each variable, what is my cutoff point? We decide that somebody's going to be deprived when they earn less than X amount. And I'm going to show you in the results what this indicator would look like, for example, if we used different cutoff points, because we did a big test with sensitivity, sensitivity analysis. But in the end, what we opted for is a six basic food basket combination. That's a methodology we've used so far in our other Latin American countries. The logic of this is that two basic food baskets means that you are not poor. You have on average one dependent, so you need four food baskets to be not poor, but you actually also need a little bit more to function in the labour market for transport, for moving around, for being able to access jobs. So we've decided that three food baskets per individual is the minimum level of income that you have to have in order to be able to develop your capabilities in the labour market. In the area of employment stability, it's quite a simple cutoff line. So we consider workers to be deprived who have no contract or who are self-employed, for the simple reason that the self-employed in Latin America are quite vulnerable because they are not covered by usual social security arrangements and they have no legal basis really for their operations. So most self-employed in Latin America are very vulnerable indeed. The other key thing in Latin American labor markets is the duration of employment, because this duration of employment determines your access to unemployment benefits and also to employment protection legislation. And here we're taking a cutoff point of 3 years, because those 3 years mean that you accumulate enough in your unemployment insurance system to be able to survive an average period of unemployment. So that's the logic behind these 3 years. I will show you, of course, that in the case of migrants, this is a very, very strict or very tough cutoff line, because they've only been in the country for such a short period of time. So it's unlikely that they've been in the same job for a long time. With regard to employment conditions, the two variables that we can use consistently in the region are basically whether workers contribute to Social Security or not. And there, the pension system is a better indicator than the health insurance system, because health insurance systems tend to have public component that is for free and that covers everybody. And then the other variable is excessive hours worked. So people who work more than the legal minimum are considered to be working too much, and especially if you consider that in Latin America, people spend a lot of time getting to their employment place and back home, it would really impact your work-life balance if you worked an excessive amount of hours. The population for all of these variables is all individuals occupied between the ages of 18 and 65 and who report information for that particular variable. So this is the standard methodology that we've used for this indicator so far in all of our papers and studies. Overall, we consider that an individual is deprived if they are deprived in one dimension at least. So for example, it could be just income, because that's a third of the indicator. Or it could be two of the other variables, which also amount to a third. So if you're deprived in one third of the indicator, then you're considered to be deprived overall. And again, this cutoff was selected for normative reasons, because the component variables of the indicator are each so important that if you're deprived in more than one of them, then you definitely are deprived overall, and it would be difficult for you to function and develop your capabilities in the labour market. And of course, we did sensitivity analysis and computed numerous cutoff lines, et cetera, to test this. For those of you who don't know the Alkire-Foster method, just very quickly to say that in the first instance, it simply counts how many people are deprived. So how many people fall below that overall cutoff line in the index. And the second indicator, the intensity of deprivation, measures how many variables they're deprived in and how intensely they are deprived. So is it just, for example, income, or is it income plus contract plus tenure, and so on. That's the A ratio that this method develops. And then the final indicator is composed of the multiplication of the headcount ratio with this intensity of deprivation, so H times A, and that gives us our overall quality of employment score. This is a score. This is a standard Alkire-Foster, and it's important to bear in mind the direction of the index. So a higher HA or MO means that the level of deprivation is higher. So it measures deprivation. Even though we call it a quality of employment index, it's really a deprivation in the quality of employment index, but that's sort of a bit of a mouthful. So let's get to some results. This is what the actual headcount ratios look like, and I apologize profusely if the Zoom pictures now cover the results, or maybe you can move the images on the screen. I just did so that I can actually show you all columns. The headcount ratios amount in the last 3 years to an average of deprivation of around 50%. And even though migrants are more deprived than locals overall, it's not by that much. So if we look at other groups in the labour market, we will find more intense levels of deprivation gaps. In terms of the intensity of deprivation, in some cases, even migrants seem to be less deprived than the local population. Now, this has a very simple explanation. Migrants have to have a contract in order to be legal residents in the country. And so that means that in some cases, or in some dimensions of this index, they do quite well. Whereas the local population often decides it doesn't want a contract, or works as self-employed unprotected workers, and so on. And it gives us an overall, this combination H times A gives us an overall index of 0.3, not that dissimilar, the results between migrants and locals. So this is the overall result. And I'm not talking too much about the first years sort of after 2010, because we had fewer cases. But overall, the situation has been relatively stable, I would say, certainly in the last 3 years. Now, this actually does show the trajectory of how the quality of employment has developed. Again, this is very important. It's important to bear in mind that when we see the trajectory of migrants here, where the quality of employment has deteriorated since 2010, the first point is that in 2010 we had fewer cases, and the second point is that since 2016 we had a greater influx of migrants, and so they've had less time to incorporate themselves into the labour market. And in particular, because we measure the duration of employment and the level of protection that workers have once they have a job, migrants are very much deprived on that particular variable, as I'll show you as we go forward. In terms of the gender gap, again, I'm going to ignore the sort of early years because we had fewer cases, but certainly for the last 3 years, we can see that there isn't, there's a gender gap both for migrants and for locals. But the lines actually cross, so there's not that much of a gender difference in terms of the gender gap between the local population and the migrants. Now, one important thing with these synthetic indicators is that they are designed to aggregate information into a single index or variable. But then, of course, the purpose of the policymaker is to ask, how did we get to that result? And to look at what dimensions or variables in the index contribute to that particular result. Now here, what's important to bear in mind is that the original weights of the index for each variable in the index are the benchmark. And if we have percentages here for each year where the weights, the contribution weights, increase above the index level weight, then that means that these people are more deprived or less deprived, if it's less, in that particular dimension. So for example, on the income front, we can actually see that the local population is more deprived on average than the migrant population. When it comes to social security, again, the local population is more deprived than the index weight would lead you to expect, and than the migrant population. This may have legal reasons, because again, migrants have to have these contracts. They have to, therefore, if they have a contract, they're more likely to contribute to social security. They may also be subject to minimum wage regulation and so on. And as we will see also, migrants are not necessarily integrating into the bottom end of the labour market. So in these variables, migrants are doing quite well. Of course, similarly also with employment status, so migrants have to have a contract, it's therefore, it makes sense that they would be less deprived on the dimension of status. But of course, where they are, as I mentioned before, where they are much, much more deprived is on the variable of tenure. So migrants aren't really protected and aren't subject to employment protection legislation simply because they either haven't been in the country for long enough or haven't been in the same job for long enough. And in terms of working hours, they also seem to work more than the local population. So the important thing to bear in mind here is if we just looked at wages, or if we just looked at whether people participate in the labour market, we'd be missing this much more nuanced picture of who is doing better and why. If we look at education levels, again, the results are very much in line with what you would expect. People with higher education do better on average than people with lower education. Rather oddly, migrants do better if they have only secondary education than local Chileans do. It may have something, of course, I'm speculating, but it may have something to do with the attitude of employers towards migrants who like employing them. When it comes to secondary education, complete secondary education, migrants do slightly worse than Chileans. But when it comes to higher education, they do significantly worse. And I'll show you that again in a minute. The higher education of migrants who have recently arrived in Chile is not as valued. And this also has a lot to do with the formal regulation of how high levels of education are accredited in Chile. This is quite a task for a migrant that requires quite a lot of paperwork. And especially if you're Venezuelan, this paperwork is impossible to come by because you can't just nip back to Venezuela and get your certificate certified by notaries, etc. But even if you're from Colombia, it requires several trips back and forth to get the requisite paperwork together. So what you will often find is that higher educated migrants are in Chile for economic reasons and are not necessarily working in their profession that they have a degree in. Migrants also do significantly worse in another sector of the labour market, which is one of the best segments, so to speak, of the labour market, which is larger companies. So larger companies on average employ workers under better employment conditions than smaller companies. But here migrants seem to be doing worse. And I thought this would be due to the fact that migrants often work in the construction sector, which is not one of the best sectors to be working in, but actually it's mostly explained by the fact that they work in the retail sector. So this is a bit of a mystery and we need to look at this in more detail. But again, we hit the problem of the fact that we don't have unlimited numbers of an unlimited N. So there's a limit to what we can do with breaking down the data further. Now, I think a really interesting slide is to look at this by country of origin. We can see here, so some immigrants clearly are doing better in the labour market than others. This graph shows it quite well. So the headcount ratio is modelled down on the x-axis, whereas the y-axis is the average deprivation score. Bolivians seem to be doing the worst, both in terms of the actual levels of deprivation and how intensely they are deprived. Whereas Argentina, with a similar level of development to Chile, is at the better end of the labour market scale. We need to add locals here to this, but the locals will probably be somewhere down here in this quadrant. Venezuelans, on average, I would expect to do better over time. So again, Venezuelans are significantly penalised by the fact that we include employment duration in our indicator. So this gives us an idea of how well or how badly different nationalities do in the Chilean labour market. I was rather surprised that Haitians do relatively better, for example, than Bolivians. They're less intensely deprived even than Venezuelans, who really have the highest level of human capital of most of the immigrants who are coming, apart from Argentinians. So this gives us some interesting results. It also raises some interesting questions. Of course, if we break down the nationality and then look at other variables, we again run into sample difficulties. But it's an interesting picture and it gives us some clues as to what's going on and how workers are integrating. Peruvians, for example, have been in Chile for longer. People are more used to employing Peruvians. So that might explain why they are relatively less deprived than Venezuelans, for example.
Kirsty,
am I running out of time?
Yes, so if you want some questions, you might want to be thinking of
Okay.
There won't be time for questions.
I've got some more slides that give you sort of the more detail of this. So the PowerPoint presentation will be made available to everyone. And I don't actually have many more slides with new results. This is just to show, for example, that higher level of education doesn't necessarily mean working in the jobs that you are qualified for, as this line here with professionals shows. So very few, relatively fewer migrants work in professional occupations, even though they have a higher level of education. Just very quickly to show that this traditional indicator of looking at informality in the labour market doesn't capture the whole picture. So this is one of the key motivations for using this methodology. There are many more people who have bad quality employment than there are informal workers. And this is because informality doesn't take account of most of the precariousness in the formal sector. And there's no big difference here between migrants and the local population. This sensitivity analysis, I'll leave for you to peruse. This is just additional detail. The interesting thing here is to show that if we take different cutoff points, this is our 6 food baskets that we actually use. And this is the new proposal by the Chilean government to guarantee a minimum income to everyone. The lines between migrants and the local population cross. So our results would be different depending on which indicator we use, but the overall trends of the indicator would still be the same. This is a spider graph diagram that shows the same principle, but also includes the other variables. And with that, I come to my conclusions. And I'm now going to move the zoom around so that I can actually see them. So generally, I would say that we were all quite positively surprised by the fact that migrants perform quite well in the labour market in Chile, certainly relative to the labour to the local population, and also because if they don't perform well, this variable tenure is a big explanatory factor. The gender gap, as I showed you, is decreasing. I've talked about higher education. Some nationalities do better than others, of course, and we can't look at ethnic discrimination. And I just showed you with the sensitivity analysis that this indicator is quite sensitive to income cutoff levels or other cutoff levels. So all of this, of course, is debatable, and the Chilean government is in the process of doing just that. They're debating this so that with this data, they can establish a formal indicator, which in the future can be used. So there are two purposes to this work. The first is to draw attention to the quality of employment per se, and to show how this indicator can be used. And I would certainly argue that this kind of measure should be used in addition to traditional measures of labour market performance. And certainly it should be used to measure horizontal inequalities within a labour market. So we could replicate this paper with gender, we could replicate it with age groups and so on. And in fact, at the end of the presentation, there are some slides that give you more information on that. But this is pretty much the end of the presentation, so I'd be happy to answer any questions. I hope I haven't taken too much time now.
Thank you very much. That was really interesting. So now it's open up for questions. So if you can raise your hand, or if you can indicate in the chat if you prefer that you want to ask a question, then I'll ask you to ask that question directly. So I'll try and keep an eye on the hands in the chat. Isabel Schutz, you'd like to ask a question.
Thanks, Lucinda, and thanks for a very interesting presentation. I thought it was fascinating. I suppose one thing that I thought was really interesting, which I suppose is specific to the Chilean case, is of course language isn't a barrier. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered what your...
Oh, it's religion. Sorry, I forgot to mention that. Not language and not religion. And ethnicity is relatively similar with the exception of Haitians.
So I was just wondering what your reflections were on that in terms of migrants faring better than locals in some senses. And also, which you referred to briefly in the conclusion, to what extent there are sort of racialized hierarchies in terms of mm-hmm. labour market segmentation underlying those differences in terms of Bolivians and other groups?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, the fact that they all have the same language and religion and ethnicity is incredibly important. On average, Chile is whiter than some of the countries that the immigrants are coming from. But it's very much a sliding scale in Latin America. We know from other studies that people who are darker skinned are discriminated against. People who have the right kind of surname do much, much better, and so on. So we have evidence for the fact that there is discrimination. But overall, I think the reception of immigrants in the Chilean labour market, especially given the short time frame that this has been happening, and I mean, we're talking about an immigration boom in the last 5 years, which has been extraordinary. So the reception of immigrants has been incredibly positive, and I've very rarely had employers make negative comments about hiring immigrants. And as I said, they tend to sort of hook into certain groups and hire them for particular purposes. Now, of course, this does lead to this stereotyping, which we can't possibly measure with the data and reflect in the data because the sample sizes aren't big enough. And there's no survey at the moment that oversamples immigrants in Chile. So, of course, what I'm presenting is averages that we get from the data and that we can sort of look at with the available information. But there are certain narratives that come through in the qualitative research that I've read and that we've also undertaken about immigrants and how they're viewed. And in particular, I think with Chile, as with many centralized countries, you also have an additional phenomenon, which is the further away you are from the capital and from the place where institutions work the most, the more abuse you would find, or the less regulation is implemented or enforced. And so, for example, this question, what we haven't done yet, we can't, for example, cross the regions with the migrants and their countries of origin. We can't do that analysis from a technical perspective. But we do know that if you're further north, migrants are likely to be working in the mining industry as opposed to in Santiago, where they're likely to be working in other sectors. And there can potentially be more abuse in regions where there's less enforcement. So that's definitely an issue. And again, I think at the moment, the best we can do is we can sort of see, okay, what does the data tell us? And then what does the qualitative analysis tell us? I think there's certainly also a story around the type of regime that Chile is. So Chile, for starters, is a relatively liberal sort of welfare state. It would be a sort of Anglo-Saxon welfare state type model, but obviously scaled down to developing country standards. And it's got a very liberal immigration regime, which makes it quite easy for migrants to come. And so until that is changed, until that is regulated, I expect this influx to continue, especially with the situation in Venezuela being what it is. Never been a protest that I'm aware of against immigrants on a large scale. So there are, of course, conflicts and there are interracial issues that come up.
Megan and Pat, you would both like to ask questions. So Megan.
Hi, thank you so much, Kirsten. Nice to see you as well. And hi, Veronica and everyone. Thank you. I found that really, really revealing and very helpful. And I guess my question really, I mean, there's a lot we could chat about, I'm sure. But I guess for me, I'm really interested in how you're proposing to integrate this a bit more with that qualitative data, which seems to be giving us another story. Because I work specifically with Afro-descendant Colombian women, and I work with Bolivians in the north of the country. So like exactly the kind of groups you've just been mentioning, who their experience qualitatively day to day might actually be of quite a lot of discrimination in the workplace and things like that. So I find this like, it's so helpful to have this big picture. And I guess I'm just wondering how you're going to be combining it with the more qualitative stuff to sort of dig down into those nuances.
So for this paper, we're just going to stick with a quantitative analysis and just show that we're aware of the issue, that there are different qualitative case studies that may be contradictory. Our intention is to publish the qualitative work as well. It's in some shape or form. We would welcome any advice and help with that going forwards. I think partially the contradiction comes from the fact that most of the migrants are in the Santiago region, or in the central regions, where employment conditions overall tend to be better, and where there's a greater diversity of industrial sectors for them to work in. And so I think that accounts for an awful lot of the contradiction, because the north really is very different, and because you have also a very high density of particular immigrants there from Bolivia and Peru, in particular Bolivians. We found very few Bolivians actually in Santiago compared to other nationalities. So it's not that there aren't any, but most of them are concentrated indeed in the north. In fact, we did a similar paper to this with regional analysis, and it comes out there as well. So I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that qualitative analysis is done in different parts of the country, and the realities are just very different.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll move to Pat next. Thank you.
Yeah, fascinating and really refreshing to see something from Latin America, which we all need to educate ourselves a little bit more than the preoccupations of Europe. And nice to say hello to Veronica as well, a former graduate of ours. So I have two-part questions. The first is, what does this index add beyond income? And also, if you were to do a measure of income based on human capital, would it tell us anything different? That's the first part. Second part is how we understand this theoretically. So it seems to be challenging some kind of dual labor market segmentation approach, but that might be an artifact of the legal requirements for employment, for getting a contract in order to satisfy your visa. Or does it lend itself more towards a human capital perspective?
I'll start with the second part of the question first, because I would certainly argue that there is a dual labour market. I would just argue that the dual labour market isn't defined by informality versus formality. So what I'm really saying here is that in the formal sector, because you've had 30 years, 40 years of labour market flexibilisation, of international development institutions preaching flexible labour markets, what's happened is that even though the legislation hasn't changed on paper, it's being used very differently by employers. And so therefore, the formal sector has become much, much more precarious in the use that it makes of existing regulation by increased use of short-term contracts, precarious contracts, using people on a self-employed basis instead of wage earners, all the things that we know from the UK, well, they're happening in Latin America as well. But of course, they're happening in labour markets where you still have a very significant proportion of the labour market that is still informal. So you've got that traditional segment of precariousness, but now you've also got this sort of undermining or hollowing out of the formal sector. So I think there is a dual labour market. It's just that the division isn't where it normally is assumed to be. So that's one point. In terms of what the indicator adds, I think you'll find some answers in the other slides that I didn't show in terms of the sensitivity. I'd say the key answer to that question is that it's not enough to have income, and even a relatively higher level of income, you have to have stable income. And the big issue that this indicator brings into the analysis is the issue of the question of whether your job or your income is stable, and whether you're protected in the social security systems. And so that, when you sort of look at the individual components of the indicator in more detail, I think that comes out very clearly. Because, for example, in the case of the migrants, if you just looked at income, then they would be less deprived than locals, even depending on the cutoff line, of course. And you can also see that migrants enter into a certain segment of the labour market, not in the higher end, but also not in the lowest end. The Chileans are the ones who are in the lowest end of the labour market in terms of income. With regard to the human capital approach, I think that's where we sort of hit one of the major issues that needs to be thought about by immigration reform in Chile. It's too difficult still for Latin Americans from other countries to validate their degrees, their certificates, etc. It's similar processes that we know from the UK. If you have a doctor, so many doctors in the National Health Service in Chile are from another country, Ecuador, Venezuela, Colombia, etc. And in their case, they are attracted by the Chilean state because the National Health Service in Chile would not function without these doctors and without these nurses. And so in some cases, there are very established procedures for legalizing your qualifications. But if you're an engineer, a forestry engineer or something else, especially Venezuelans who can't go back to legalise their qualifications, they end up driving Ubers. So there's a huge loss there of human capital compared to the potential. Having said that, especially Venezuelans are looking to return. And so these migrant flows can be very fluctuating. We saw that in with the Argentinians who came to Chile after the 2001 crisis in Argentina, where suddenly half of Chile, especially Santiago, was full of Argentinians. All waiters suddenly seemed to be Argentinians. These weren't people who were born waiters, they were often engineers working as waiters. And then 5 years later, as soon as Argentina recovered, they went back home. So most of the Venezuelans you speak to, they're only in Chile on a temporary basis to gather some assets and save and then go back to their own country. So I'm not 100% certain that Venezuelans in particular are likely to stay. Whereas, for example, in the case of Peruvians, Bolivians and Colombians, they are more likely to stay in the country. That's a little bit of a speculative answer, I'm afraid.
Maybe that's what a complex picture it is and how they're different. And as you say, the sort of the capturing that sort of dynamic perspective would be really enhance this, wouldn't it? It would be really suggestive when you have a few more years of data. So
yes.
I'm aware, there don't seem to be any more quick questions, and I'm aware we're almost out of time. So I'm going to thank Kirsten very much for a really suggestive and interesting presentation. And before you leave, I'd just like to alert you to some upcoming events hosted by the III. So next Tuesday at 12:30, there's a seminar on the changing geography of social mobility in the United States. And next Thursday at 12, you can hear about wealth inequality and social inequality across the globe. So do look on the III website if you're interested in either of those. And once again, thanks very much for your presentation, Kirsten.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.